make them work better. When I talked about that red electron sitting on the tip of a needle, it's an extremely oversimplified physical Gedanken experiment, a thought experiment, diagram. In reality, those electrons are moving around. There's a sea of electrons bouncing around all over the place on a conductor like copper. The one or two electrons in the outer shell of that copper are very free to move, and they're moving around in all kinds of ways. So to talk about the red one sitting right at the tip, I can talk about that, something that happens for one picosecond, but he's not going to dwell there very long. And some of them are moving fast and some of them are moving slow, and the fast moving one is the more likely one that's going to jump off the surface. Very similar to what happens with water molecules that are evaporating off your skin. That water really is a fluid, and all of those individual water molecules at the molecular level are moving very rapidly, bouncing all over the place, bouncing off of each other. They don't actually touch each other, but they're bouncing around. And the hot ones, the ones that are moving faster, and that's what heat is, average kinetic energy of individual molecules. The molecules that are moving faster are the ones that are more likely to jump off the surface, are more likely to contribute to the evaporation that's taking place when water is evaporating from the surface. So the hot ones are the ones that are leaving. The cold ones are the ones that are moving slower, and they're sitting down there and not as likely to leave. Therefore, the hot ones leaving leave the cold ones. That is the molecular level of understanding of why evaporating water off your skin when you climb out of the shower or you climb out of the ocean, that's why you feel cold. The evaporation creates cooling by that mechanism. The hot ones are the ones that are leaving. Alrighty. I'm trying to remember who's the next person on the list. We said Howard, Steve, Brian. I think those are the three that signed in. I know that Joe's got a question. Except for Joe, is there anyone else that I've missed who signed in with a question? Give me your call letters right now if I missed you. K2RIW in the deck net.
WA2SAY. I don't have a real question, but I have a suggestion.
Okay. If it's on the subjects that we've already discussed, and you're adding to it, and you're going to give us a further understanding, go right ahead, Doug. Like to hear from you. And hit your mic a little bit harder. WA2SAY. Guy I worked with for a whole lot of years. K2RIW.
Hiya, Dick. Okay, I'll try again. I'll try to be a little bit louder. You suggested Teflon sheets to put in that capacitor. I wonder if Mylar would work. You could get Mylar drafting film at a drafting supply store, which do exist on Long Island. There's one over on, I forget what the road is, by the railroad station in just west, a couple of blocks from the railroad station. So I wonder if Mylar would work instead of the Teflon sheets, which are going to be hard to get.
First of all, among microwave operators, in my opinion, Teflon is pretty easy to get. You sign into the microwave reflector, the WA1MBA group, Whiskey Alpha 1, Mike Bravo Alpha, and tell those guys that, hey, I'm looking for a small amount of Teflon, 10,000th of an inch thick or 5,000th of an inch thick. You'll get a number of guys volunteering immediately. So among microwave operators, Teflon is not too difficult to get a hold of. I'm sure it's in the McMaster catalog among many, many other places. And now your question is, will Mylar work? And I think the answer is yes. Mylar is a little bit lower in dielectric strength, a little bit higher in loss tangent than Teflon. It's a good insulating material, just a little bit lower in performance than Teflon. I think it'll do the job. I have used Mylar as the chimneys on the 4CX250Bs on my parallel kilowatt amplifier as the air chimneys directing the air through the anode and out to the outside world. And the Mylar works quite well. However, in that environment where they're being heated to 200 degrees Fahrenheit, it does eventually, the Mylar turns brown. And so the loss tangent of the RF energy going across the Mylar will eventually age it and turn it brown. Teflon won't do that. So at least for the first year or so, I think the Mylar would work like a charm. Good virgin Mylar, I think, is a material also with high dielectric strength and very low porosity. I don't think it's got any microscopic holes like non-virgin Teflon might have. So good suggestion, Doug. And thank you for that. Okay, Joe was now telling us about 800 volts, 45 watts is all he's getting at 225 milliamps. I know he'd like to be getting a lot closer to 100 watts or so out of that rig. Give us a little bit more information as to what you know as the symptoms of this rig that's not giving you the proper power output, if I got you correctly there, Joe. So be A2RYY, K2RIW in the second. What band is it on also?
WS line about the top one.
Station on Mylar tape.
Okay.
Line about the top one.
Yeah, we got both Paul and Mel more on Teflon, so let's go to Paul first. Go ahead, Paul, WS2N.
Good evening, Dick. I was just wondering, you know, the Teflon tape that they use for pipe fittings, would that be applicable for what you're talking about, or too thick, or, you know, I mean, it's just dirt cheap. You get a roll for like a dollar, you know.
I think the answer is no. The pipe fitting Teflon is a Teflon-like product that is extremely soft and very, very thin. And it's usually kind of narrow. You're supposed to wrap it on the threads of a pipe, and it acts like a grease, and it does give you a much better seal. So that particular Teflon tape, which is in every single plumbing store, I don't think is quite adequate for this operation. Maybe I've misunderstood what you're saying, Paul. WS2N, K2RIW.
Yeah, I was just wondering, you know, you're talking about availability. I mean, this stuff is dirt cheap, so, but if it's no good for that application, then forget about it. I just throw it out there because you get it everywhere, you know. But if you can't use it, you know, for that purpose, then forget about it. But I just thought I'd throw it out there as far as, you know, availability. It's just so easy to get. Back to you, Dick.
Yeah, I think Brian is going to be looking for 1 or 2 inch squares of Teflon to properly cut up with his scissors to act as the plates that he puts on the variable capacitor, if I got him correctly. If it's the C1 capacitor of a Pi network, then he's going to want a 1 inch square or a 2 inch square. To get a 1 or 2 inch square, a few thousandths of an inch thick, with Teflon, by way of that process, of the role of pipe fitters Teflon tape, I don't think you'd be able to easily do that. Is that correct, Paul?
A 1 inch is popular. Yeah, there's no question about it. They sell it half and 3/4, 1 inch, but anything bigger than that, I think would be hard to get.
Okay, it's a long shot, and I guess a really crafty amateur could take some other kind of thin sheet of material, maybe even paper, and lay the strips of Teflon tape across it and fabricate a poor man's equivalent of sheets of Teflon. But to do that with no porosity between the layers, that's tough. Mel's got a much better suggestion. You wait and see. K2KEY, go ahead, Mel.
I've used by rolls of Mylar tape that I wind when I wind a number of transformers. Scotch makes that Mylar tape that sticks very well. In fact, it sticks, you know, when you stick it, you better stick it right the first time because the Scotch on stuff really attaches itself. So you get that, they got an all different width. So when I was wound a number of transformers, I used that, and it has a very high breakdown, I think it's, the heck they told me, I think it's 10,000 volts per layer, Dick, over.
How thick does it have to be, that Mylar, Dick?
JC2, QIQ.
I think it should be like about 5,000ths of an inch. Glenn recognized, but Mel, the Mylar tape, he doesn't want glue strips on it, I don't think. I guess he could glue them to the stator plates and let the rotors go whizzing by. You're sure you're talking about Mylar tape and not Kevlar? I said Kevlar. I meant Captan. You're not talking about Captan. You're talking about Mylar. Mel first. Go ahead. You there, Mel? Maybe he got called away. Glenn, KC2QIQ, where would you go to get sheets of Teflon? Go ahead.
Actually, you answered my suggestion already. The name of the tape is Kapton, and it's readily available on the internet. As a matter of fact, it's got its own website, www.kapton.com. And that stuff is extremely high temperature, very, very high breakdown voltage, and it's self-adhesive. So if you want to put something in between a plate and trim it with an X-Acto knife, you can get that stuff to lay in there, very high temperature. And also, if you ever want to take it off, it doesn't leave the mess that the Kapton tape does when you, if you ever try to remove it. K2RAW, KC2QIQ.
Okay. You told us to use Kapton tape, and then you said it doesn't leave the mess that Kapton tape uses. Maybe I misunderstood you. Run that by again, Glenn.
I'm sorry. This doesn't mean, it doesn't, the Mylar, the Mylar stuff is, once it's on and it gets warm a few times and you peel it off, it usually leaves a lot of residue behind. I'm sorry, I meant Mylar is the one that's messy.
Wonderful. Has acrylic transparent that goes down to, I think, 1/32 of an inch. I'm not sure that might help.
Beautiful. Yeah, there's all kinds of plastic sheet materials that would substitute. But that's going to be Brian's last resort after he does a cleaning job. I mean, that radio used to work. And if that capacitor is restored to the cleanliness it had on the day it was manufactured, I think he's no longer going to get any arcing. But it's nice that he has in his hip pocket the sheets of plastic-like materials as a way of increasing the dielectric strength between the rotor and stator plates of his particular variable capacitor. Anybody have any further comments on this one?
I mount the capacitor in a cucumber jar and vacuum it. He gets a vacuum capacitor.
Gee, I wish I had thought of that. That's a beauty. Okay. And you've got to be careful when you do that. The so-called passion curve, P-A-S-C-H-E-N, is a man who studied the high voltage breakdown versus air pressure. And as you start creating a vacuum, air breaks down easier and easier. It takes less and less voltage to create a breakdown until you get to something like 100,000 feet of altitude of air pressure, so to speak. Hard vacuum is good, but in between sea level and hard vacuum, there's a whole lot of no man's land where everything arcs over, so to speak. And the explanation for why air behaves that way is darn interesting. And by the way, if you put greater air pressure around a capacitor, opposite of common sense, you increase its dielectric strength. If I've got two metal plates close to each other and they're starting to arc over, and I put them into an environment where I double the air pressure, I will almost double the voltage required before it'll break down. So higher air pressure helps. Also, so does sulfahexafluoride. When it comes to pressurizing coax cables in high-power broadcast transmitters, because you don't want that transmitter cable to arc over, sulfahexafluoride is an extremely good material. Not quite as good as Freon 12, but you got to be careful. Freon 12 will increase the dielectric strength of the atmospheric pressure gas that's in your cable. That's the good news. If it does break down, Freon 12 starts making a noxious gas. I think it's a phosgene gas. So Freon is good to pressurize if you don't get an arc over. And if you do, make sure it's in open air. Anyway, any further questions or comments? K2LIW.
You usually get the phosgene gas, Dick, WSON?
Yeah, you've done heliarc welding and whatever, so you've seen arcing in all kinds of gases, so tell us a little bit about that, Paul, go ahead.
Did anybody measure?
You take Freon 12 and you put that in the presence of copper that's being heated, and that will give you the phosgene gas. By itself, it really won't. It definitely will. If you're heating copper, you know, and you're around that gas, you'll know it.
And the reason why they worry about this is that your high-power coaxial cable does have a copper semiconductor. So if you're pressurizing your airline on a broadcast transmitter with Freon 12, and you do get an arc over, you're arcing over to that copper semiconductor, so you're going to make the phosgene gas. Alec, you want to add to this?
Well, God, I love Fujin. I live in Fujin. did anybody measure the lactic constant of a cucumber and if there is any difference between a sour one and a sweet one?
It turns out if you go to a book by, I can't think of the name of the author now, very large format book, can't think of the author's name, in which all the substances that are dielectric, partially conductive, biological, non-biological, yes, almost anything you think of, somebody has measured the dielectric strength of it, even your cucumber. So all kinds of things. Paraffin wax, for instance, is a material that is extremely inexpensive and extremely good for high voltage circuits. So if you've got an arcing taking place on something that doesn't have to move, and you drip paraffin wax in there, quite possibly you can stop the arcing. I've done some experiments with that at the 100,000 volt level with my wind source machine. I had a kind of capacitor which was arcing over around the edges, and I coated those edges with paraffin, the so-called sealing wax that's used for people that do food canning. Anybody have any further questions or comments? K2RIW.
So here is the solution for the capacitor. Just spray it with hot paraffin.
That might help, but you got to be very careful not to get the paraffin in the rotary joint, because the rotor does have to be well grounded for the capacitor to work well. So you got to keep the paraffin out of the rotary joint on the end of the rotor where it does become grounded. But that's another possible approach. Somehow protect the rotary joints at the end and dump the whole thing in hot liquid paraffin. That might do it. After he does the cleaning job, I recommend he clean first. And the manufacturer of that radio back in World War II never intended these kind of techniques to be applied to it. I guess they didn't have Kevlar and all of these other crazy materials. Captan. They didn't have Captan in those days. It's a more modern material. Okay, let's get back to Joe, to B2LYY. I think your difficulty is you're unhappy with only getting 45 watts out with the 225 milliamps and 800 volts. And you have reason to believe that that tank circuit is resonating. In other words, you see a nice clear dip when you would operate the C1 capacitor of the Pi output network. You see with a power output meter, like a bird watt meter, the power go to maximum as you adjust the C2 capacitor. And neither of those capacitors run out of range. And you're fairly sure that the tube itself is not a gassy tube. I mean, these are things that I would worry about as far as where's my power output going. Are my controls running out of range? Do I have a good dummy load? Do I have an accurate way of measuring power? Do I have a tube that's alive? Am I giving the tube the right amount of bias and the right amount of drive? So B2RYY, K2RIW.
Those are a bunch of real good questions.
Okay. Ready for you for any other more expository that you would like to give us, Joe. Go ahead.
I don't have the information on the tube bias. I have no. I didn't check that. I don't know if that's what that is. The service manager is not giving me very, very much specific information. I can only tell you how the radio is operating currently. I will get more power out of it. Usually, taking an SSB and put audio into it, I can have the thing drive over 100, give me over 100 watts out. But the plate current is going up to about 300 mils also.
So when you talk about sideband power, is that peak envelope power of 100 watts that you're seeing, Joe? Or is there some way you put a continuous tone into the sideband mode and it gives you 100 watts out? But I think you're saying in the key down mode, CW, you only get 45 watts. By the way, many rigs also have an AM mode, amplitude modulation. And in the amplitude modulation mode, because you want the peak envelope power to be 4 times higher than the average carrier power, when you're not talking into an AM transmitter, AM transmitters will have a significant cutback in the power output when you're not speaking into the mic. So how is the sideband mode giving you more power than, I guess, the CW mode? And the fact that you can get the power in the sideband mode suggests that the rig does have sufficient drive capability of that final tube. So B2RYY, K2RYW.
Yes, it uses a pair of 6146s for final tubes, using a pair of those. And I'm talking about the reason I'm running at that current level because the thing states 180 watts DC input, the SSB-CW, 50 watts DC input for AM or FM. This thing does not have an AM module in it. It only does FM. It doesn't do AM, so that's that. It only basically does SSB and CW.
So, in the sideband mode, with a continuous tone going in, I think you're saying you're getting 100 watts. What power output do you get in the CW mode? What power output do you get in the FM mode? And what currents and voltages are present during those? Back to you, Joe.
Voltage is probably the same as present on all modes. It's a matter of the... I'm not using an FM, so forget the FM portion of this. I mean, it works in FM, but I'm not using it in that mode. I'm just trying to get the thing straightened out in SSB. It will give me 100 watts indication on a meter if I put a test tone, a 1,000 hertz tone, into the radio. I'm not using two tones, I'm using one tone. And it will drive my bird watt meter to over 100 watts of indicated output.
When it gives you 100 watts of output, I think your unhappiness is due to the fact it's drawing more current, and I think you're saying the tube runs hotter. But bear in mind now that a sideband transmitter is designed to have a certain duty factor of human speech going into it, and a continuous 1 kilohertz tone going in there, except for brief periods, is pushing the sideband mode beyond the original design technique, if you know what I mean. So, and to your knowledge, is the transmitter rated for 100 watts of peak envelope power output in the sideband mode? And even if it is, if you're getting 100 watts with a single tone, that's an extremely good sign, because most sideband transmitters that are rated for 100 watts peak envelope power can only do that with brief pulses of power from human speech with a certain crest factor to it. The average sideband transmitter, with the way it's designed, if you gave it a single continuous tone, you're putting the power supply under more than the average amount of current it was designed for. Therefore, the voltage fades on most power supplies. Therefore, the power output starts coming down. So a typical sideband transmitter of typical design that puts out 100 watts peak envelope power might only give me 85 watts or 90 watts of continuous single tone in that sideband mode, because the power supply fades. To B2RYY and K2RYW.
And to EO, Dick.
Rich recognized, but Joe first. Go ahead, Joe.
I'm looking at the specifications for the book, in the book itself, and it says 180 watts DC input for SSB, CW, 50 watts DC AM, FM. So whichever module you have the radio, that's what it does. It's supposed to be running the power lower, obviously, for FM. That's all I can tell you. It does not give you the rated power output of the radio. It only tells you the DC input for the transmitter, and it tells you the power consumption of 330 volt amps on transmit.
Okay, that's that particular Yaesu rig. Let's see what Rich has got to say, and maybe he's really already run into that particular rig. N2EO, KTRYW.
Okay, Dick, I was listening for the M. I think he said he's got a pair of 6146s. Am I correct?
Roger.
Okay, I'm familiar with those tubes because that's what my Collins gear uses. There is 6146s. As far as the grid bias, that should be set for 40 to 50 mils of resting current. In other words, when it keys the mic, doesn't talk, there should be about... Collins tells you to set it for 40 mils of resting current. There's about 800 volts on the plate. He should load up to about 230 mils at resonance, which should give him about 115 watts out. Those are Collins specs for a pair of 6146s.
50 milliamps at 800 volts, if I did it correctly, is 40 watts of dissipate, 40 watts of total input power for that recommended bias. And I think Joe is biasing him a little bit higher than that. But when he told us about 225 milliamps, that's under drive conditions. Out of curiosity, Joe, what was your standby current, your standby bias current in the sideband mode. Go ahead.
Fifty mils indicated for IC current.
That sounds just right. 50 mils per tube. Is that true, Rich? And 2EO, is that 50 mils per individual 6146?
No, for a pair of them, Dick. I should have made that clear. Collins specs for a pair of 6146s. Well, they say 40 mils. That's the same thing. 800 volts on the plate. About 112, 115 watts out. That's for 180 watts input.
And if you did go as high as 50 mils, that would be 40 watts of dissipation in the standby mode, which would be 20 watts per tube. And I think the plate of a 6146 is rated for 25 watts of average dissipation. Is that about right, Rich? N2EO, KQRIW?
I'm not sure on that one, Dick, but what I gave you is the Collins specs, and they tell you to load them at with 800 volts on the plate. They tell you load for 230 mils of plate current for a pair. Now, these are 6146As they use. He may have the B in there, which he can go a little bit higher.
From what I'm hearing, Joe, you may be getting close to rated power output of that transmitter. You're within shooting range of what it should be doing. So B2RYY, K2RYW.
Well, if the current meter says if I load it up for 225 mils, I don't think I have a problem with the power supply. So the book says you have 800 volts on the supply. Now, yes, I can stick a meter in there with the drive down and probably see if I actually have 800 volts on DC on the plate. So I think I probably do. It sure seems like the radio's not giving me the right output for the what it's drawing as far as current. You have a problem with those numbers? 225 mils, 800 volts was supposed to be on the plate, and getting 45 watts out or so in the tube position, which is the same thing as CW.
Dick, you should check the screen. The screen should be running about 275, 300 volts.
Okay. I will do that. That's a good idea. They don't give you any test voltages in this thing, and it's really like a simple operating and simple alignment, and the alignment does not go into any kind of troubleshooting depth at all for this particular radio. And the radio is about 1980 vintage.
I wonder if you've got a copy of the RCA tube manual, Rich, and you could look up 6146 and find out what RCA recommended for single sideband service, what voltages on screen and grid and plate and currents and standby and whatever. That would help a little bit. In fact, I guess there's an equivalent of the tube manual in the back of the Radio Amateur's Handbook. Rich, the tube functions that are in the back of the Radio Amateur's Handbook, if you looked up 6146A or B, would that get him into the ballpark of being able to test whether or not his rig is supplying the right voltages and currents? N2EO, K2RIW?
Yeah, Dick. I have a manual, but it's all the way upstairs. It's hard for me to get up there right now. He may have 6146Bs in that. They run the screens a little higher on the B. I'm not exactly sure how much higher. But what I'm giving you is I've been working with this Collins stuff for quite a while now, and those are the specs. 800 volts on the plate. About 325 volts on the screen. I don't know the grid voltage, but the grid bias should be set. So with 800 volts, there's 40 to 50 mils of plate current. This is for a pair of tubes. And that's basically it. You should pull about 230 mils at 800 volts and get about anywhere from 110 to 115, 120 watts. On 10 meters, it'll drop down to about 100 watts. This is what I know about the Collins KWM2, the 32S3, and These all employ 6146As.
Okay, do you need any fill on any of that, Joe? And I guess you've got a little bit of homework to make some more measurements of voltages on screen and whatever. Also be sure that the particular 6146 Alpha or Bravos, whichever you're using, do they have a good vintage? Are they known to be non-gassy tubes with good emission? By plugging them into another known good rig or stealing 6146s from another rig, there's ways you can do tube substituting to find out if you are getting low power output. Does the low power output condition follow the tube or follow the rig, if you know what I mean? But I think you're getting close. I'll admit that the 45 watts and the key down mode certainly does sound low. However, the fact that you're getting the peak envelope power in the sideband mode is a good sign. Quite possibly the designer of the rig was very conservative in the CW mode for fear that the guy is going to put a brick on the key for half an hour. He doesn't want to overload things. W-A-2-R-Y-Y, K-2-R-I-W.
One more thing. He checked his neutralization. If the neutralization is off, he will not get maximum power at minimum plate current. He should try going off the side so the plate current rises off the dip and see if the power goes up. If the neutralization is out, the way to neutralize that is to remove plate voltage, remove screen voltage, leave the filament running, and put a 50-ohm dummy load with an RF voltmeter across the dummy load and adjust the neutralization capacitor for minimum feed through. Back to you, Dick, and I'm going to stand by in 2EO.
That could be a pretty good test, as I see it, Joe. When you're looking at the power output at your bird wattmeter, and you take the C1 control, the input capacitor on your Pi network, and you rock it back and forth. If maximum power output does not occur close to the point where the current plate current of the tube goes into a dip, it's not the complete answer, but it suggests that the neutralization could be off. So V2RYY, K2RYW.
I read that paragraph in the manual for this thing, and it does say to check that at a higher frequency, and it does coincide. Minimum current seems to equal maximum power. If I go off resonance with the plate tuning, the power will go down, and the plate current goes up substantially from like 225 up to like over 300 mils. It can't go that high. So that seems like that's set correctly.
Okay, that's a good sign. How else can we help you, Joe? Do you have any further questions?
Well, since I don't have another pair of 6146s, and I don't have another radio to put these tubes into, I guess for right now I'm sunk.
Well, you've got a whole lot of friends. If you appear at the one of the next flea markets, you may find some 6146s. You may on the air find somebody that'll loan you some to try them out just to see if yours are soft. Soft tubes or slightly gassy tubes can give you some pretty weird effects from time to time. And once in a blue moon, tubes will recover by just letting the filaments run for a few hours with enough cooling air through the system and let the Gettering do its job. Assuming that when you look at the side of the tube, it looks nice and silvery as opposed to that whitish color you get when a tube is truly gassy and the Gettering material has all been consumed. There was a flea market today, a Hall of Science flea market. I wonder if anyone within the sound of my voice went to the Hall of Science flea market. I'd like to know a little bit about what you saw. You certainly had darn good weather. Was there a good crowd of sellers, a good crowd of buyers? Was the traffic good? Anybody who went to the Hall of Science flea market today, please give us your call letters right now. K2RIW in the TechNet.
Quebec Golf Zulu, just with something on the 6146s for the Yaesu Quick.
Okay, Bill recognized. Anyone else with went to the Hosark? Give me your call letters. H2R. Sounds like Bernie went. Go ahead, Bernie.
Well, I'll have to give the disclaimer. I'm a Hosark member, so Obviously, I'm going to give it a positive effect. It was a nice flea market, in my opinion. It was bigger than the one last year, which is always good. Managed to pick up an assortment of connectors, cables, that kind of stuff I needed. Also, we had a great VE session with, I believe, almost 18 people, 15 or 18 people testing, I believe. So anyway, I think it was a very successful day.
That's good. Make me a very rough guess. How many sellers, how many buyers, or how many total people at the gate, if you happen to know where Bernie Bed?
No, I couldn't really give you an answer. I was the talk-in station, so I had my head down most of the morning, and then went inside as a VE for the testing, so I did not really get to see that much.
Okay, good information. Bill, tell us what you know about 6146s. WB2QGZ, K2RAW. Or is it? QGZ. Go ahead.
There you go. I think we were talking about an ST-101, is that correct?
Joe, what was the Yaesu rig you're talking about?
It's an FT-101ZD, Zebra Delta.
You know, Bill. Go ahead, Bill.
Okay, well, I can tell you that it's an earlier model of that radio. I think it was a, might have been a 101E. About 15 years ago, thereabouts, I had to change out the finals and do a complete end-to-end alignment in one of those radios. And I had fooled around with 6146s I had laying around. I fooled around with some domestic matched pairs. My recollection was they might have been a B, I'm not sure. I could never get it to tune up properly. I could never neutralize it properly and have it work over the whole span of bands that the radio would make. What I eventually had to do to make it work, and it seemed from my discussions in the intervening years that it was not too uncommon a situation, is that you needed to turn up Yaesu's tubes. When I bought a set of 6146s from Yaesu in California, they came in Japanese character covered boxes. It seemed like they were not a domestically produced tube. Now, these days, I don't know what you're going to do for tubes or if those tubes are still available. But I dropped those tubes in. Everything tuned up very nicely, and the radio worked. As far as I know, it's still working to this day. So the short story is I banged around probably with three different sets of tubes, including two sets of match pairs. And the only way I could make it work properly was with Yaesu's match pair tubes that seemed to be made elsewhere.
Until we have more information, Dick.
Yeah, Rich recognized. I'm going to go back to Bill in a second here. First here, Bill. Bill, your audio is very heavy and a little bit harsh. I think you're using quite a bit of speech processing. You might want to back off on the audio just a little bit. I think you're banging against the side of the repeater. With the 6146s that you were using, other than the Yaesu tubes, do you happen to remember roughly what kind of power output you got in CW or sideband mode, and roughly how much did it improve when you went over to the Yaesu tubes? Can you slightly quantify the rate of improvement there, Bill? WB2QGZ, K2LIW.
K2SAY.
Doug also recognized, but Bill first.
Okay, I may be a little bit better now. My issue wasn't necessarily output power. I want to say that the thing was making, it was, barely squeezing 100 out on 10 and was probably capable of maybe 150 if I really wanted to, maybe a little bit more on 80. My problem was the inability to neutralize the tube on all the bands and to have it not oscillate and to not work squirrely. So it wasn't a power output problem, it was a broadband neutralization problem.
Okay, good information. And I think you're saying the neutralization worked right on the Yaesu tubes as the rig had been designed for the Yaesu tubes, but almost any other brand of tubes, it was kind of squirrely and hard to neutralize, but it did neutralize well on the Yaesu tubes. Is that sort of what I heard there, Bill? Go ahead.
That's correct. Someone had anecdotally told me later on that the tubes that Yaesu provided had some interior component capacitance that was different from what seemed to be available domestically. and explained it that way.
Okay, there's a gimmick capacitor inside the tube of Yaesu. That's a guess. Rich next, and then Doug after that. Rich, N2EO, go right ahead.
Okay, Dick, the tube I believe Yaesu used the same tube that Ken would use, which was actually made by Toshiba, called an SSM 2001A. That's the Japanese version of a 6146, an S2001A. I don't know where you would get those today. Toshiba does not make tubes anymore, as far as I know. Another thing Joe may want to check that occurred to me, the government released a whole bunch of 6146Ws, and they're no good. I wouldn't use them. I had very bad luck with them in the Collins. I know other people who've had low power conditions. The W is the strong. I don't know what's different about them, but they seem to require more drive than an A or a B. So he should look and see if that's a 6146W. If so, get rid of it. On the Yaesu and Kenwood rigs, you can modify the neutralization circuit. I believe there's a capacitor, a fixed capacitor across the variable cap. What happens is the neutralization capacitor runs out of range on the American tubes. You have to change that fixed capacitor to bring the trimmer back into range where the plates are not open or fully meshed on the capacitor. Another good suggestion that I read about, and I've had extremely good luck with it, is a substitute, not just a substitute, but an improvement over the 6146 A or B, is a 6293. 6293 is a very rugged 6146. It was used as a modulator for radar transmitters. I have a bunch of them here. I have Raytheons. I'm using them very successfully in a KWM-2, the KWM-1, and I've got a single 6293 in a Johnson Viking Ranger 2 that runs AM. They're very hard to get. I just bought a
repeater. Time out.
Okay, so what got covered up was the 6293 can be bought from Radio Days. I was hearing him on the input. Sound good information, and I thank you, Rich. Bill earlier was worried 6146 is still available. It is my guess that that tube is going to be available for a lot of years to come. That tube is everywhere in a zillion rigs that run with tubes. And there's a certain hardcore group of people out there that just love tube rigs. They're not completely convinced that solid state, no tune rigs are the way to go. That the old-fashioned rigs with the real tuning and loading control to the Pi network and all the adaptability that gives you on various high VisWire antennas and the way it sounds. There are people who just love the sound of tube amplifiers, particularly when it comes to hi-fi versus solid state. So if that tube ever ceased to exist, there would be somebody coming out of the woodwork selling it at a premium price because there's a demand for it. That's an opinion. Doug, W2SAY, give us lots of audio, and what do you know about 6146s, if that's what you'd like to tell us about? You got it, Doug.
Hey, Dick. I'm sitting in front of the computer, and I Googled 6146, and I found a site with data sheets. It's http://faculty.frostburg, F-R-O-S-T-B-U-R-G, .edu. PHYS LATTA AE 6146 AMP 6146 B 6146 B .html, and it's got the 6146 B and 6146 data sheets. And the contents are introduction and general data. Typical operation one includes linear RF power amplifier, class AB1. Typical operation two includes RF power amplifier, class C. Special performance data on heater operation. Maximum ratings. General and mechanical considerations and characteristic curves. More characteristic curves. And miscellaneous information, tube outline, and biasing diagram. So if somebody needs the data sheets, looks like you can get them here.
Okay, lots of good data on the 6146. Now the URL you just gave us, the address you gave us, is extremely long. Very few people are going to get that one right. However, you found it by Googling 6146. Did you Google 6146 A, B, or just plain 6146? And when you did Google 6146, was it the first item that came up or the fifth item that came up? Which was that, Doug? The A2SAY with lots of audio? K2LIW?
I think I Googled 6146 tube. And it was not the first item that came up. It was, I don't know, the third or fourth or fifth or something like that. But look for this, if you want to write it down or somebody wants to write it down, I'll go through it again. faculty.frostberg.org/6146amp/6146b/6146b.html.
Okay, some people may have gotten that. It's a very long one. However, if you Google 6146 tube, T-U-B-E, and maybe the third or fourth thing that comes up, because in the lower left-hand corner of each response you get from Google, they will tell you the address, and if the address begins with Faculty Frostberg, you're on the right one. And you open up that one, and you get these pages and pages of data that Doug is telling us about. And there's many a situation where it's simple to tell a person, just go to Google, use this as a search word combination, go to the third item, and there it is. Or in this case, just look for Faculty Frostberg as part of the beginning of the URL. Good information. Thank you, Doug. Anybody with any other stories on 6146 is a very favorite tube among radio amateurs. Give me your call letters right now, K2LIW on the TechNet. Okay, looks like we've covered that tube. Let's make sure we haven't left out. Let's make sure we haven't left out Kent. W5EJ.
I can add something.
Okay, yep. Eric's going to add something. Let's give a quick drop first and see if Kent is in there. W5EJB. We're going to wait to see if you're there. K2LIW in the TechNet. I hear nothing. Go ahead, Eric. You've got it.
Hi, Dick. A couple little tidbits. The differences between the A and the B are the intellectual capacitance. The spacing between the grid and the screen has changed between two versions of the tube. And different manufacturers do use, actually, RCA used one type of screen formation. I think it was Raytheon used a different one, which actually allowed for more screen dissipation. But the difference between the Japanese tube, which I think Rich is absolutely right about, is the transconductance of the tube plus the intraelectrode capacitance is way different. And the difference is between the base of the tube and the actual connection to the screen. So, it varies from manufacturer to manufacturer and from tube to tube. That's why you find some things different in neutralization. The differences in the cathode coatings also came with the later tubes, which made them a little more efficient, a little less drive, and a little less idle current. The older tubes, you really have to always run towards the top side of Idlecon, especially if you're using AB1, the single sideband survey cell. That was typical of most 6146s. And the same thing was also true of the 2E26s and how they were made, because it's a, you can consider it a baby 6146. K2IWK3K.
Okay, thank you. Lots of good information. One of the things that I predicted earlier, Eric, is that the 6146 is such an extremely popular tool for Sedan many decades that people who sit here today in fear that the tube is going to disappear.
I doubt it. You know, there's these church amplifiers, and churches are usually poor organizations. 70-watt amplifiers with two 6146s in them, and audio service feeding 70 volts to feed all those speakers.
So you're predicting the 6146 is going to be around for a couple of more decades. Somebody, somewhere on the planet, even if it's Svetlana, is going to be producing that tube or an equivalent. Is that sort of what you're saying, Eric? Go ahead.
Yeah. They'll be around for a while. The Russians like them too, by the way.
Okay. Very popular tube worldwide. It's going to be here. Not to worry. You don't have to hoard them. In the process of people, you know, filling up their shelves with 6146s that are slowly going gassy, you don't have to do that. And I'm guessing that a 6146 runs at such low voltages by my standards, 800 volts, that so-called wake-up procedure is not required. In the case of a very high vacuum, very high performance, very high voltage tube, I'm talking about a X-band traveling wave tube. If that tube has sat on the shelf for 6 months, and you just suddenly yank it off the shelf and throw it into service, because it's a $10,000 item in some cases, a high-power version, you really want to go careful. You want to do nothing but filament voltage for a few hours first to let the gettering in there do its thing. And then maybe you want to put it, you can't put it under general voltage. A traveling wave tube, you either give it the full voltage so that it properly focuses the beam, or you give it nothing. But there's a so-called wake-up procedure that you use for those tubes. I think a 6146 does not require that. Now, you being a tube man from way back, Eric, I wonder, have you ever seen any evidence that if a guy took a 6146 off the shelf where it's been sitting there for 5 years, and if he puts it into service and either does or doesn't do a wake-up procedure, would there possibly be a difference in performance during the first 10 minutes versus 4 hours downrange, if you know what I mean, when the tube has been woken up? KE2EJ, K2RIW.
Yeah, let me tell you a little story. K2IW, K2J. I can instantaneously turn my klystrons on. I don't want to do that. Actually, when all things are normal, and I turn that transmitter on, it's going to take 10 minutes before it'll even allow me to even think about putting any kind of plate voltage there. By the way, I pulled out my old RCA handbook here. 6146B maximum plate voltage and a class AB1 service, a single sideband, maximum is 750 volts. Typical 600. Maximum current 220 mil. 35 watts of plate dissipation, and you're starting to push it at that point, so you gotta watch it. But anyway, the thoriated tungsten sitting underneath the cathode, which has thorium on it, you really don't want to be sucking electrons off that thing until it gets up to temperature. And that's generally a tube killer. So, but if you've got an old tube that's been sitting on a shelf for a while, maybe a little bit gassy, I would run the filaments without any juice at all for, you know, about 5 or 6 hours. And then slowly give it some grid current and plate current. Now turn the grid current up and up so that the tube doesn't conduct. Bring the plate voltage up to a reasonable point. Of course, if you're using a transmitter, you really got no control over that unless you stick your power transformer on a variac and light your filaments independently, which I doubt anybody would ever bother to do. But the best thing that you can do is, you know, hit it with as maximum grid bias as you can to make sure the tube's cut off, give it plate voltage, and then slowly crank the grid bias back down to the point where you get to the idle current.
and that will give you a nice clean surface on the cathode, ready to give you lots of electrons and make the tube work efficiently. K2RW, K2J.
Now, when you gave us the voltages of 750 plate voltage maximum, was that continuous commercial service, or was that intermittent commercial amateur service? I see it, yes. Question number one. Question number two, I know on your very expensive tubes, you've got the filament voltage on for something like 5 or 10 minutes before you hit the tube with high voltage. And that's to make sure that the cathode has thoroughly come up to operating temperature. Because if the cathode has got hot spots, and you're emitting from those hot spots, you've got very different beam focusing. In the case of a velocity modulated type tube, although maybe your tube is a negative grid. So, my real question is, other than poor focusing characteristics, what other kind of contamination or damage occurs to a cathode if I don't allow it to come up to full temperature before I start asking for peak emission? What's the mechanism of damage there, if you happen to know, Eric? KE2EJ, K2RIW?
Yeah, K2RIW, K2EJ. It's not in terms of velocity, it's in terms of chemical migration. Whatever residual gases there were in the tube, it's usually going to be clinging to the wall around to get it. Okay, it's that silvery stuff that you see. But there's still molecules in distribution in the envelope. So when you start a tube up cold and it warms up, whatever few molecules are sitting in that glass envelope get excited. Right? When the cathode is cold and you start to draw current, whatever little bits of impurities are there, rather than collect on the wall of the tube, collect on the cathode. It causes a chemical change to the cathode itself. It winds up getting hot and cold spots. So the tube manufacturers always recommend that you bring your filament up to speed and give the cathode enough time, especially if it's a separate cathode. The tubes are direct cathode filament combinations, when the filament's glowing, the cathode's glowing at the same time. It doesn't really apply there. But you usually don't find that in anything more than a triode. Oh, by the way, the 750 volts is ICAS. If you want to do continuous service, that's 600 volts max, period. What's the dissipation? I think dissipation is around 24 mils, rather. That's at zero. Let's see. I'm saying that wrong. Okay. Yeah, no, it's 77 watts max, right? And the grid dissipation is about 3 watts in that case. Screen current would be 250 volts max. Well, it doesn't matter whether it's CCS or ICAS. And typical plate current from at the peak of the envelope of audio, let's say, is about 125 mils. Yeah, the idle current's around 24-25 mils in either case. And that's two-tone modulation at 30 megahertz. Okay, go ahead.
Repeater, timeout. There's an amazing number of amateur transmitters that are running higher voltages than that. And so they're really pushing the tube. And I guess they can get away with it because the tube can take it, because those numbers maybe are a little bit on the conservative side, and I think you're using the RCA tube manual. There's a significant number of transmitters out there, I think, running 800 volts on the plate, Eric. Where is the authorization coming to do that? And I think the answer is there is none, just that they've always done it that way and they've gotten away with it. And if the tube gets shortened to 3 years of life instead of 8 years of life, that the transmitter manufacturer thinks he's not going to be hit with that one, so he doesn't worry about it. Is that approximately what's going on here, Eric? Go ahead.
You got to remember, RCA was always very conservative about the thing. Whereas that IMAC is just the opposite. So, give yourself 10 or 20%. But if you're going to start drawing more plate current, which is the key, not necessarily the voltage, because the distance between the electrodes are big enough that you're not going to have breakdown. So, you know, in smaller tubes, you try and pull that, you wind up with a melted mess inside. But no, those are rugged tubes, so I could